You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Ben Mathis here with just a couple of quick announcements before we start the show. We're in the midst of our GoFundMe campaign to cover our production expenses for the coming year. And if you can, I'd like to ask for your help. I'm trying to raise our full production budget for 2016 by the end of this year, pretty much by Christmas time. So if you're enjoying the show, if you're getting something out of all this that I'm doing, then let me know by going to GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics, or you can go on our website at kickasspolitics.com and click the donate button. It's a chance for you, the listener, to participate in what I'm creating here, and there'll be some fun rewards for donating, chances for you to interact with me and the show more, and all sorts of neat stuff. You can give $5 or $500. Every little bit counts, and it shows me that Kick-Ass Politics isn't just falling on deaf ears out there in podcast land. So let me know you hear me. Go to GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics or go to our website at kickasspolitics.com and click on the donate link. Another way you can help out is by going on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends, followers, minions, or whatever you call those people who like your vacation selfies and comment on your social media rants. And if you do this for me, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my recent guests. Now be sure to include a link to the podcast on iTunes so your friends can subscribe, and don't forget to tag us in your posts so we know that you participated and we can include you in that drawing. And if you really want to get ambitious and double your chances of winning, then promote the show on both your Facebook and Twitter. In fact, you'll be entered to win for every time that you recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on social media. So make your friends my friends. Just help me gain some new listeners, and you'll have a shot at winning a cool prize every week. Thanks a lot, folks. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Every day, about 1.5 million people view the online news show The Young Turks, or any of over a dozen shows produced or affiliated with the Young Turks Network. The Young Turks is the brainchild of Cenk Uygur, who founded TYT in 2002, and since then it's become the world's largest online news show with over 2 billion YouTube views. On today's podcast, I'll visit the Young Turks studio in Culver City, California, to talk with the creator Cenk Uygur and his co-host on the Young Turks daily news show, Anna Kasparian. Plus, I'll talk with John Iadarola, co-host of TYT's Think Tank. We'll talk about the future of news in the digital age and why TYT's irreverent mix of political news and entertainment is catching on with millennials. We'll also talk about filibustering judicial nominees, Trump on SNL, the American immigrant experience, and much, much more. Coming up with the Young Turks in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm at the Young Turks studio in Culver City, California, and I am joined by the Young Turks themselves, Cenk Uygur, Anna Kasparian, and John Iadarola. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
And having me over here to the nice new studio here.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, it's an amazing thing that you've built here, and it's the most popular online news show. Cenk, you're the original Young Turk of the Young Turks. Talk about how all this began.
It began in a room probably smaller than this. In my living room 13 years ago, we started a radio show on Sirius Satellite Radio. And then about 3 years in, we decided to go online video. We rented a little studio in Mid-Wilshire. It wasn't even a studio. It was just an office building. And we turned one room into a studio, and we were off to the races.
Well, you now have, what, 2 billion views on YouTube now?
Yeah. So let me be clear exactly how that works. So on just the Young Turks channel, which is the main flagship show that we have over 2.2 billion views. So that's public. Everybody can see. You just go to the About page on our YouTube channel and you see. And it goes up every day. And then on the network overall, we're at, last I checked, 3.1 billion views. So the network has 30 channels, 12 of them that we run out of the studio that you're seeing here.
Wow, not bad, not bad. So how do you get to 2 billion views on YouTube with a show like this?
Practice, practice, practice. a lot of trial and error, fail your way to success. Seriously, now they call it A-B testing, but back in the day it was called trial and error. And so we would put up a video and then I would say, okay, oh, look, it turns out that title sucks. Let's change the title, right? And let's figure out how to, you know, put in the tags that you need in a video so that people can find it when they search. So a lot of blocking and tackling. That's the nitty gritty of the behind the scenes stuff. But the main reason why it was successful is not any of that. It's because we were doing something that the market wanted, needed, and nobody else was doing. So we were saying, hey, you know what? The government isn't always telling you the truth. At the time we were saying we should have never gone into Iraq. When we were a radio show, it was pre-Iraq war, and we were the only national show outside of Democracy Now! That was saying, don't go, it's a lie, don't go.
For a period, you were also a political commentator on MSNBC while you were running Young Turks, and you were told that you were, I guess, too outspoken, and Washington, for whatever reason, wasn't happy. Talk about the difference between the culture of TYT and the culture of the, I guess, mainstream traditional big news networks.
Right. Their culture is, hey, let's figure out who we need to please, right? Corporate parents of whichever station you're on, advertisers, politicians that you need access to. So here are the Young Turks. The only people we're trying to please is the audience. So that gives us a huge business advantage, among other things, right? Yeah. If they're not, if they forgot that they're supposed to appeal to the audience and we remember that, well, obviously we're more likely to get the audience. That's why we're routing them on the internet. That's why they have no chance against us in the online world. The only reason why those old media guys are still around is because they have this enormous infrastructure on television that gives them a revenue advantage, right? But that's going to, you know, slowly recede over time. It's receding right now. In fact, they're in a lot of trouble right now. So the culture of be careful, don't offend anyone. Oh, no, 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 please, please don't say anything bad about politicians is an anathema to what we do here. They view them as honorable gentlemen. We view them as paid spokespeople for their donors. So that's true of Republicans, very largely true of the Democrats. So we don't give a damn about those guys. And when you say that, you know what happens? The guy in the audience goes, oh, my God, that's what I've been thinking. Yeah. That's totally true.
Anna and John, you both came straight to TYT right out of college, and you co-hosted TYT University. What was it about the Young Turks that intrigued you rather than, say, applying for a gig at one of the mainstream traditional networks?
Well, I didn't come to the Young Turks straight out of college. I actually worked for a CBS affiliate in Los Angeles called KNX. And I hated it. So, I mean, no disrespect to, you know, the news team that works there, but it was very different from what I envisioned myself doing in the field of journalism and in media. And so I just felt like there were these old school rules that were keeping me down. Like, of course, paying your dues, which you have to deal with to some extent at TYT. But I wanted to be able to speak honestly about the news and not worry too much about seeming objective and you know, seeming like I'm neutral on everything, right? I knew that there was truth to every story, and I wanted to report the facts, but also let the audience know what the truth was. So at that time, you know, it was during the Bush administration, all these terrible things were happening with torture, the war in Iraq, you know, the surge in Afghanistan, and no one was speaking about it honestly, which is why I came to the Young Turks. A colleague at CBS approached me, told me that there was a temporary position at TYT, and I was interested because I was trying to save money to go to Europe. So I decided I'd work this temporary job as a second job. And after the 2 weeks was up, I'd be on my way. I came into the studio, saw Cenk do the show. And when I saw how honest he was and how unfiltered he was, I realized that this was a place that I wanted to work at full time.
Did you ever make it to Europe?
I did. I went to Europe for a month.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. How about you, John?
I actually had no interest in being involved in the media in any way. I'd never done any TV or radio or anything like that. I was in undergrad. I was a political science major, and eventually I went on to a graduate program, a PhD program in government at UT Austin. And along the way, when I went into college, I had no political training. I mean, the way that any person has. My parents rarely spoke about politics, if at all. I couldn't have told you when I was a freshman in college if my parents were Democrats or Republicans or if they even thought about that stuff. I had sort of been developing my value system, as people do, reading books. I remember reading a book by Rush Limbaugh when I was really young, like 13 years old. I read this book by him, and it made a lot of sense at that point. And then 2 weeks into my college career, this is sort of cliched, but 2 weeks into my college career, 9/11 happened, and suddenly, although I had no interest in politics, suddenly politics is everywhere, and everybody's talking about it. And so I started taking the sort of gen ed classes that you do. And around this time, the Young Turks was on Air America Radio, and I came across that. Podcasting was starting to pick up. And so amongst a number of other shows, I suddenly started to listen. And this was sort of my the revelation that this world exists, that there are people who think the way that I do. I had never had any interest in watching cable news or anything like that. And so as I went through my training to become, I wanted to be a professor of political science. I wanted to write about politics. The whole time I was listening to their show and loving it and spreading it to my friends. And at some point they wanted someone to contribute for the university channel. And I was such a huge fan. I was like, well, if I can get them to mention my name on air, I'll do whatever it takes. And eventually, after about a year of submitting videos on my own, it became a possibility. But even when I started working here, it wasn't to do any on-air stuff. But this is so, as I said at the beginning, I had no interest in being involved in the media or being a political commentator or anything like that. I only had an interest in being involved in the Young Turks.
As millennials, do you think that millennials no longer have a taste for hard, not hard news, but straight news? Look at The Daily Show and all these and what you're doing here. Do millennials prefer to have their news in entertainment form?
I don't think there's really any such thing as straight news. I think
traditional
that
news, Dan Rather.
Yeah,
you know.
So traditional news, it had its place, it had its time, but I think that it's now an antiquated concept. And the reason why I say that is because we all have our biases. We all have our political leanings, and to go on air and pretend like you have no biases is ridiculous. I think that that's actually being very deceptive to your audience. It's another thing when you have your political leanings, but you're willing to report the story, you know, as factually as possible. And then you share what your comments or your opinions are. I mean, that lets the audience know exactly what they're getting and who's reporting the news to them. Yeah. Because here's the thing. When I was in journalism school, I remember objectivity was emphasized quite a bit. But I remember some of the professors saying, well, if you have a leaning and you kind of want to get that point across, you could do it by interviewing certain people who agree with you, and then you can use their quotes. So the biases get out there,
yeah.
You know? And so all of this BS about, yeah, like, oh, we're objective. No, you're just trying to be neutral. And in the process of doing that, sometimes you kind of hold important information back from your audience.
Well, and also the idea of being neutral, of trying to establish that there are two sides generally, and you're going to reveal what both sides think, that is so, it has so many inherent flaws. Most issues don't have two sides. They have three or five or 10 different sides. The idea that they're all equal, that they all come from an equal position in terms of research, in terms of authenticity, is by itself, I think, ridiculous. And also, so I lectured a little bit on media at UT, and one of the things that we try to teach the students there was that while the old school news broadcasts would avoid the bias of being clearly liberal or conservative, there were still all sorts of other biases that they had. They had an instinctive, necessary business bias towards supporting the establishment, towards supporting the people who are paying their paycheck. I mean, those are sorts of biases that I would say are every bit as distorting as being kind of liberal or kind of conservative.
Well, yeah. So you would say that Young Turks is honest in that it is opinionated.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's our brand. I remember someone asking me a few years ago, like, what's your brand? What are you known for? What do you do? And I remember being kind of like freaked out about it, because from a marketing standpoint, it's good to have a so-called brand. I'm like, I don't know. Am I like a women's issue political commentator? Is that my brand? And then I realized, no, honesty is our brand.
Yeah.
We're honest with our audience, and I think that's the best brand to have.
And we also, I mean, we don't really see ourselves as primarily the people who deliver the basic information of a story, or that we're going to cover every important piece of news. And we tell people constantly not to trust the things that we say, to have multiple sources of media that you use on a day-to-day basis, just like we do. What we try to do is use our life experience, the ridiculous amount of time that we spend talking about and thinking about and researching the news and politics, to provide a useful context to the things that are going on, to be able to link the events of the day back to important things that happened 6 months ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. Because day to day, people don't have the time to think about politics at that level. That's what we can bring to them. Anybody can read the front page of the New York Times and know that a bomb blew up in a plane and blah, blah, blah. But to know what policies might have influenced a particular news event, mm-hmm. or the relevant people behind the scenes, that's what we try to bring.
Like I said, you describe yourself as an independent progressive. Do you guys, as kind of the younger generation of journalism and politics, do you think that that's where millennials are headed, to more aligning themselves with a political philosophy than necessarily a particular political party?
I think so. I think that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of support for a third party candidate among younger generations. That's one of the reasons why Ron Paul got a little bit of attention, during past elections. It's because he speaks out against some of the wrongdoings of Democrats and the Republicans, which is something that we do on the show quite a bit. But right now, it's really difficult for me to find a candidate other than Bernie Sanders that I can identify with that has principles, that actually acts based on those principles. Right now, I mean, as Cenk kind of alluded to earlier, everything has to do with money. Everything has to do with corruption. And it's really difficult to find any type of candidate who's principled on the issues and who hasn't been corrupted by that money. So you hear these debates about how the two-party system isn't working in the United States during every election cycle. And it's true. Usually it's younger generations that are bringing up that point. They feel like they're always voting for the lesser of two evils. That's how I felt during the last election. When I was voting between Romney and Obama. Obama abandoned his base. I didn't want to vote for him. So I ended up voting for a third-party candidate, Jill Stein, to make a point, because I live in California. That's not going to impact the election, but I wanted to make a statement about my political beliefs and how I just didn't want to play a role in voting against the lesser of two evils.
Did we all vote for different people? Who'd you vote for, John?
Obama.
Oh, you did vote for Obama. Okay. I voted for Obama in the general election, but I voted against him in the primaries.
Who'd you vote for?
Even though nobody was running against him in the primaries.
Yeah, who did you vote for?
Yeah. Out of principle, I wrote in...
Who was that?
Roseanne Barr.
No. I wrote in Larry Lessig, because Larry Lessig's the one guy that I was sure would get money out of politics. Yeah. Back then, he had no intention of ever running for president at all, never thought about it. He was a Harvard law professor. And I'm like, that's the one guy I could trust to get the money out. So I'm going to write. Because in good conscience, with Obama, I mean, it's as Anna said. In fact, let me quote one of our viewers who I think put it best. I ran into this young woman at an airport and I said, hey, are you going to vote in the next election? I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was right next to an election when we had run into each other. She said, no. And I said, why? And she said, after Obama, what's there left to hope for? Because he said he was going to change the way Washington worked, and he made no effort to do that. Like, you can say, hey, he tried to change healthcare policy or this policy or that policy. But the way Washington works, with the lobbyists in charge and the donors in charge, it's completely unscathed. It goes on exactly as it did before.
And sorry to interrupt you, but, we always, there's this running joke on the show about how it's 5% change you can believe in, because it's 5% change, right? He doesn't really fight. And the Affordable Care Act is a perfect example of that. So the Affordable Care Act is something that Republicans should be applauding, because it's forcing people to buy into private insurance, right? Mm-hmm. You don't buy into the private insurance, well, then all of a sudden you're going to get harmed when you, you know, do your taxes. You're going to get penalties or whatever. And it enrages me because there are no cost controls, right? Premiums are already going up. And so this is the Affordable Care Act? Like, what the hell is that? And so I'm supposed to be happy with Obama's victory on health care? That's not a victory for me. A victory is, you know, of course, there are small things, like you can't get denied if you have a pre-existing condition. Those things are great. But again, 5% change you can believe in. It's not real change.
And that 5% dwarfs anything that I'm getting rhetorically or in terms of policy positions from Hillary Clinton so far in the forums and the debates. Obama, I think, deceived us to some extent about what he actually either wanted to do or realistically could do if he became president. But Hillary she's not even implying that she has any grand plans. Yeah. I think that in the same way that Trump is sort of just saying, I am rich, support me, she's coming in and saying, look, you know, I'm probably going to win anyway. I can just grind this thing out. As long as I don't rock the boat, I'm probably going to make it through the primary, if not the general election. And I think that a lot of people justifiably are excited about the prospect of a female president. They have some affection built up for Hillary Clinton and the Clinton name over the past two decades. But she hasn't done anything to earn the support that she has right now, even in terms of deceiving us the way that Obama did.
I think that we just missed it. You know, all those change placards? I think he had other placards built called Pocket, so it would be Pocket Change.
Yeah. And they just never brought out one and the other.
Yeah.
So it sounds like everyone kind of feels gypped here. So
yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back for some more with the Young Turks. Back in just a moment. This portion of the podcast is brought to you by Audible. Audible has over 180,000 audiobooks available to download for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And right now, Kick-Ass Politics listeners can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com and go get your free audiobook. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with the Young Turks, Cenk Uygur, Anna Kasparian, and John Iadarola. In 2005, you guys held a 99-hour live on-air filibuster during the congressional hearings of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. Why was that the one that you guys felt that it was worth losing some sleep over?
Yeah, so that was a great defining moment for us. A lot of progressives stepped up. We started it on our own. We just took an internal vote, said, should we really do this? Should we stay on the air as long as it's going to be exhausting, as long as it takes to get the Democrats to actually do a real filibuster? And then the cavalry arrived. People started hearing about it. And then Tom Hartman and Jane Hampshire, and just, I'm leaving out 1,000 names, John Amato, all these great websites and talk show hosts that were progressive started joining in. The reason we did it is because it turns out in hindsight, we were 100% right. We were worried that Sam Alito was too extreme, and that if they weren't going to filibuster Sam Alito, well, then they were never going to filibuster any conservative justices. and George Bush could put, you know, Dick Cheney on the court, and the Democrats would keep talking about keeping their powder dry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were right in a couple of ways. One, the Democrats kept their powder dry for the entire Bush administration and never unleashed on him in a way that they should have, both politically and by law. I mean, how many laws did he break, including warrantless wiretapping? And the Democrats let him get away with it completely. And then secondly, we were right because Sam Alito was one of the justices who voted on Citizens United to give away our democracy.
Well, the only one they could actually block was his personal lawyer, basically.
Yeah, and that's because the conservatives blocked
exactly,
her.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Harriet Myers.
Wisely, I would say. They saw that she was not fit for the job.
So who spent the most hours on camera with no sleep in that experience?
So back then, it was the three main hosts were me, Jill Pike, and Ben Mankiewicz. Ben happened to be out of town because he's also the host of Turner Classic Movies. So he wasn't able to appear on it. So I put in 78 of the 99 hours.
Oh, Jesus.
And Jill wasn't that far behind. She was, I don't know, in the 60s, maybe, I think high 60s in the number of hours she put in.
Wow. I wonder, is that a record bigger than any filibuster in the Senate, do you think? You know? How does that compare?
Know. That's a good question.
Well, I don't know. Rand Paul just had that epic one over the budget deal. That lasted 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And he actually called it a filibuster.
What happened to the filibuster? It used to be Jimmy Stewart going on for like 24 hours or something. Filibuster doesn't seem to mean anything anymore.
We did a final judgment, one of our like definitive, like, this is what you need to know about this issue videos about that. It, regardless of whether you think there should be a filibuster or not, if it should have developed the way it did through the history of the Senate, while we had it, it meant something and it represented something. It represented an attempt by the minority to stop something terrible from happening while risking your own political reputation by standing in front of the country and stopping all activity. But now you use it for everything. You risk nothing because generally you don't even stand. You just say, right. I will filibuster. Or you don't actually even filibuster. Rand Paul didn't filibuster. He asked for 20 minutes to speak, and they gave it to him. That's a speech, and a short one at that, not a filibuster.
Yeah, not at all. Well, do you guys see anything else on the political horizon, short of a Trump presidency, that might be filibuster-worthy?
Well, look, all of these guys are painful to think about as president on the Republican side, let alone Hillary Clinton, right? So,
You're anti-Hillary too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So wish us luck.
yeah, good luck with that.
Okay. Yeah. So look, Hillary Clinton, just like Barack Obama, is the establishment, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want things to continue as they are, and a lot of people do, then vote for Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. and she'll continue things almost identical to what they are today, right? And if you're powerful, you're rich, you should love that. I mean, these rich guys that are fighting against Hillary Clinton, their greed knows no bounds because she says, I'll let you keep all your money exactly as it is today. You're already one. And they're saying, no, I want more. I want more tax cuts. I want more deregulation. I want to be able to pollute more. I want to be able to cheat more on Wall Street. I want to keep more of the money I cheated to win in the first place, right?
And they're likely to get more of that even with Hillary Clinton because she'll almost certainly be facing a Republican Senate and a House as well.
Yeah, they already bought the Senate and the House, so Hillary Clinton has no chance of getting anything done. Anyway, if she were inclined in that direction, and she's not inclined in that direction. So, I mean, Ted Cruz, though, out of all of these parade of horribles in front of us, right, is, in both senses of that phrase, is the worst demagogue. And I think that he actually has a chance of winning. And, I mean, you can't filibuster a presidential candidate. but if I could stop one guy, I'd stop Ted Cruz. And I think that if you're a Republican out there and you think, like, oh, that means I should support Ted Cruz because these libs don't like him, right? No, you're missing the boat. John Kasich has a decent point to make about what he did with the budget in Ohio, what happened with unemployment in Ohio. You want to support a reasonable Republican who you think has had success. I understand going towards Kasich. I'm not trying to stop the strongest Republican from winning, right? No, Cruz is a dangerous, dangerous guy. And he's going to be dangerous to the Republicans as much as he is to the Democrats. And by that, I mean, I don't care about the political parties, as you can tell from this conversation. I mean, conservative voters, liberal voters, the guy is a maniac, and I don't want him anywhere near power.
Well, you know, it's interesting how your political philosophy has evolved because, Cenk, you say that you started out as a Republican and now you are a self-described independent progressive. What was the turning point for you?
So there was a lot of turning points. It was an evolution of my thinking. First of all, I'm part of an extinct species. So there was also apparently a meteor involved. so I was a liberal Republican from New Jersey. So if you remember Governor Tom Kaine, I supported him. And he was a perfectly moderate, reasonable guy. I think even today he would be run out of the Republican Party. I mean, they might light him on fire. Back then, you could be socially liberal and economically conservative. On the economically conservative part, I haven't changed my mind at all. So I don't like it when Dick Cheney says deficits don't matter. I don't like it when Bernie Sanders says deficits don't matter. Not that Bernie has said that recently, but...
I don't think so.
Right. But there are no... But, oh, I'm sorry. Let's not... I shouldn't put it on Bernie when he hasn't said it. Krugman has said it in the past, okay? Mm-hmm. So I don't agree with either one of them. I think deficits do matter, but I realize over a long period of time that Republicans don't care about the deficits at all. They never balance the budget. The last Republican to leave office balancing the budget was Eisenhower, okay? who are the guys who balanced the budget or made the deficit much, much better? Clinton balanced the budget. He was a Democrat. Now, Barack Obama, I mean, you... Not only will you not get this out of conservatives, they'll never, ever, ever admit it, but it's a fact. You don't ever hear from the so-called liberal media. He has taken down the deficit tremendously. He was handed a giant, over $1.2 trillion yearly deficit by Bush, and he's whittled it down, right? So if you care about lowering the deficit, you care about balanced budgets, you're 1,000 times better off under Democrats than under Republicans. There's just a lot of propaganda, a lot of marketing. They got actors like Ronald Reagan. They got reality hosts like Donald Trump. It's all a mirage. Now, that's on the economic side. On the and by the way,
Yeah, and Reagan wasn't concerned about getting the deficit under control at all. I mean, that's the definition of supply-side economics, I guess.
That's exactly right. I mean, you were talking about the myth. Yeah. I mean, the myth of Ronald Reagan. He gave amnesty to illegal immigrants. Okay, these are realities. He negotiated with terrorists and the Grand Ayatollah, okay? He sold them weapons, right? He'd be run out of a Democratic primary today as way to the left of Bernie Sanders on those issues. There's no way he could get elected as a Republican dog catcher today, okay?
Yeah.
So one last thing to answer that question. All these things were evolving, and I was seeing that the hype and the propaganda and the falsehoods of the Republican Party, and then they launched the Iraq War. Then they started torturing people.
Political finance reform is a big issue for you. What do you think is the solution there?
Yeah, we got to get money out of politics. Otherwise, this is a sham. We don't even have a democracy anymore. So here's what I mean by that. Princeton did a study that looked at policy for over 20 years. They looked at 1,800 different policy positions. And it turns out public opinion had no correlation to the policy that Congress passed, okay, that our government passed. No correlation. That means we don't live in a democracy. Public opinion is irrelevant. Now, what something did have a direct correlation to public policy and the laws that got passed. Gee, I wonder what it was. Oh, right. The donor views. You see, if it turns out the politicians get paid by the donors, who do they work for? They work for the donors. Okay, now everybody knows this. In the country, that's why Trump is winning on the Republican side. Yeah. Bernie Sanders is surging on the Democratic side. That's why when Bloomberg did a poll recently, 83% of Democrats and 80% of Republicans said money is corrupting politics. It's the biggest no-brainer. The only people who don't acknowledge it are the bought-out politicians and television that mainly gets all of that money in TV advertising.
And five Supreme Court justices.
Right, and the five Supreme Court justices who were put on the court by corrupted politicians who took that donor money in the first place and told them, hey, listen— And by the way, even some of the liberal justices vote with corporations more than they have ever done before. Because yeah. Clinton and Obama yeah. will be proud. They'll say, oh, I got a Latino woman and give me credit and they're great on social policy and they are. But then, oh, don't worry, though. They're very pro-business. No, no, that's exactly what I am worried about.
So should I take this in as an endorsement of Trump then? Anyone?
I'll tell you what. That's... The media is ignoring the number one reason that Donald Trump is successful. You know, of course, he's got the braggadocio, he's entertaining. But the real reason why he's succeeding is because he's saying, hey, I'm not bought like these guys. I know because I'm the guy who used to buy him.
And I would hope that when he finally flames out, if he does flame out, that the people who have become engaged with the primary in a way that most of them probably haven't in the past, who see something in Trump that they like, some authenticity or whatever, hopefully they'll retain that hunger for an authentic personality. The only tragedy really is that behind, so he's freed from the influence, the corrupting influence of money other than his own, to say what he really believes. The problem is that he doesn't actually have much behind his personality, behind his reality star appeal. And hopefully in the future, the Republican voters will say, we want that authenticity, but behind it, we want someone with a coherent vision for the future, for the world, for the country.
Didn't you see SNL this weekend? Any thoughts on Trump on SNL?
No.
I've read quite a few of the reviews, but I haven't watched it.
The reviews were very good to Larry David.
Yes.
I thought Larry David way outshined him. He was terrific as Bernie Sanders.
He's a natural.
And that was Andy gets an extra $5,000 now.
I wonder if they'll actually pay out on that.
They said they will.
Oh.
Yeah.
He doesn't need it.
Yeah, he's the guy in the country who probably needs it the least. But I think that Bernie Sanders was the role that Larry Sanders was born to play.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about another issue that's become huge in this election. Cenk, you immigrated here from Turkey when you were just 8. Anna, your parents are Armenian immigrants. Has the experience of being first and second generation Americans in any way informed or influenced what you're doing here at Young Turks? And what do you think about how ugly the immigration debate has gotten this time around?
Well, just to kind of touch on the second part of your question, Cenk mentioned how Trump appeals to a lot of voters because of the fact that, you know, he isn't taking campaign donations. Yes, that's part of it. But I think another thing that resonates with a lot of Americans is his hatred for immigrants, right? And the propaganda against immigrants has been so significant and so severe that there are people out there who are willing to fight one another instead of fighting the system that's keeping them down, which drives me insane. Watching my parents come here, I mean, I didn't watch them come here, but they came here with nothing, okay? And they didn't come here because they wanted to get involved in crime and to destroy the country, right?
They weren't rapists and murderers?
Not rapists and murderers. They came here because they wanted a better opportunity, not only for themselves, but for their family. And so think about how much courage it takes to leave behind everything you know, to go to a foreign land where you know no one, where you have nothing, and to build everything from the ground up. That's what immigrants are trying to do. And for someone like Trump to demonize them and make them seem like they're all rapists and criminals, especially if they happen to be Mexican, is so ridiculous and so disgusting. And the fact that he has a fan base based on those hateful comments makes me realize that our country has a long way to go when it comes to civility and even education on the issues.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, let's take my dad as an example. Right now, Trump would say, no, he's the guy that I built the door for. He's a successful businessman, you know, eventually owned property like Trump, owned a couple of buildings in New Jersey. But he didn't come here that way. When he came here, he had no money. He would literally sell pots and pans. He was old school on the streets of Hoboken. He tutored kids in math when he barely spoke English, right? And so when he first came, he was poor as poor can be. And they would have won. Trump would have thought that's the first guy we keep, a Muslim guy coming in here poor. I mean, God knows what he's here for. Trump has literally said that about refugees coming in from the Middle East, right?
Yeah.
And another guy he would have kicked out is Steve Jobs' dad, who was an immigrant from Syria, right? Would have kicked him out. We would have never had Apple. We wouldn't have had my dad set up the successful business that he did. And so, look, it's called the American Dream. If you read the Statue of Liberty, it doesn't say, give me your rich and kick out everybody else. It says, give me your poor, your wretched refuse of the world, and I will open up that golden door for them.
Yeah.
That's the point of America. And these guys, they're the ugliest people on earth. I mean, why don't we support Donald Trump, right? I mean, so you're right. You keep money out of politics, kind of. He's not going to do anything about it. He just says, I'm not taking any, right?
Because he doesn't need to.
But he's opened the door to fascism. I mean, they beat up a Latino guy at one of his protest. I mean, one of his speeches the other day. The crowd
didn't hear about that.
And the crowd is chanting USA, USA while they drag the guy out of the room. Trump doesn't do anything about it, right? So he's opened up a really vile Pandora's box. And what I used to say is, hey, like I know that some conservatives, some right wingers hate it that a Mexican immigrant, a Muslim immigrant, anyone who they don't like, once they become a citizen, they're 100% American. They have the same exact rights as you. They have the same exact privileges, responsibilities, and they can't stand that. So what did Trump do? He's like, oh, maybe we just change the Constitution. We get rid of the 14th Amendment, and we don't have birthright citizenship anymore. Maybe I'll kick half your families out.
Or don't even get rid of it. Just deny that it actually exists or our interpretation of it is accurate. He's got some great lawyers on both sides. They say, yeah, it doesn't mean nothing.
Well, before we go, Young Turks has expanded rapidly over the past 5-10 years. You're on YouTube, you have the subscriber network, Roku, Hulu. What's the next big challenge for the Young Turks?
So even when we started out as a small radio show, first interview I ever did with a paper in Pittsburgh, because we were on a local station there, they asked me what my goal was, and I said world domination.
How's that going?
Pretty good.
Okay.
So we're the largest online news show in the world. We're the largest online news network on YouTube. We're among the first partners Facebook ever had, ABC News, Young Turks, and NFL, first three video partners Facebook had. So our immediate goals are to continue our domination on YouTube, crush it on Facebook, just like we did with YouTube, crush it on all these platforms. We're number one in minutes viewed in almost every platform that we're in. And eventually the goal is to be larger than CNN all over the world, including all platforms, including TV. So it's to be the largest news network, period.
Well, you're certainly headed in that direction. Cenk Uygur, Anna Kasparian, and John Iadarola, thank you very much for joining me on the show, The Young Turks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Ben.
Thanks again to Cenk Uygur, Anna Kasparian, and John Iadarola for having me over to the Young Turks studio for a chat today. You can watch The Young Turks on YouTube or at tytnetwork.com. They also have a Young Turks podcast on iTunes, so go check it out. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends and suggest that they subscribe. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my guests on the show. So be sure to tag us when you do so. You can tag us on Twitter at @KAPolitics, or our Facebook page is just Kick-Ass Politics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.